name is Jonathan Bunch. I'm Vice President at the Federalist Society. We're very grateful for your attendance. Thank you for your commitment of time today. We have a great program. The event is titled Silence, Our Global Trends to Ban Religious Defamation, Religious Insult, and Islamophobia, A New Challenge to First Amendment Freedoms. We have a very distinguished group of panelists and presenters. We thank them for their time as well. This event is coincidental to the publication of the book Silence by two of our distinguished panelists that I will introduce, Nina Shea and Paul Marshall. Nina Shea, immediately to my left, is an international human rights lawyer. She has served in that role for more than 30 years. She joined the Hudson Institute as a senior fellow in 2006, where she directs the Center for Religious Freedom. For 10 years prior to joining the Hudson Institute, she worked at Freedom House, where she directed the Center for Religious Freedom, an entity that she helped found. Since 1999, she has worked as a commissioner on the U.S. Commission for International Religious Freedom. She's been appointed as a U.S. delegate to the United Nations main human rights body by both Republicans and Democrats. For over a decade, she has worked extensively for the advancement of individual religious freedom and other human rights in U.S. foreign policy as it confronts a resurgent Islamic extremist ideology, as well as nationalist and remnant communist regimes. For 7 years, ending in 2005, she helped organize and lead a coalition of religious groups that worked to end religious war in southern Sudan. In 2004 and 2005, she helped advise in the drafting of the Iraqi Constitution's religious freedom provision. And since 2005, she has authored and edited four widely acclaimed reports analyzing educational texts in Saudi Arabia, all of which have been translated. She regularly presents testimony before Congress, delivers public lectures, organizes briefings and conferences, and writes frequently on other religious freedom issues. She's a regular contributor to National Review Online, where you probably see her commenting quite frequently. And her 1997 book on inter-Christian prosecution in the Lion's Den remains a standard in the field. With Paul Marshall, she is the co-author of the forthcoming book, Silence, that we will discuss today. Paul Marshall is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute Center for Religious Freedom and the author and editor of more than 20 books on religion and politics, especially religious freedom, including more recently Blind Spot, When Journalists Don't Get Religion. And he is also the best-selling author of the best-selling award-winning survey of religious prosecution worldwide, Their Blood Cries Out. He's the author of several hundred articles, and his writings have been translated into more than a dozen languages. He is frequently in demand for lectures and media appearances, including interviews on ABC Evening News, CNN, PBS, Fox, British, Australian, Canadian, South African, and Japanese broadcasting corporations, and Al Jazeera. His work has been published in leading publications in the United States and abroad, including the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and many others. From those introductions, you can see that our guests are eminently qualified to comment on this topic. The final note that I'll make is the book that they have published, Silence, we were not able to make available for purchase outside the room, but it is available on Amazon, Apple, and any bookstore where you purchase best-selling books. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much indeed to the Federalist Society for arranging this occasion. Thank you to you for being here, and that also includes the people who will be watching us on the web. If you hear that buzzer again, which was just going on, do not worry, it's a call for a vote. If you have to go and vote, then do so, but otherwise you can safely ignore it. Neil and I, with the book Silence, we both worked on all of it, but this morning we'll divide our labor. I will outline problems of defamation of religion in the Muslim world, and she will focus on attempts to export these restrictions and problems to the West. What is it we're talking about here? We use terms such as defamation of religion or blasphemy. But in the Muslim world, the actual accusations are usually far more vague. There is no systematic pattern. A country such as Pakistan is very unusual in having explicit blasphemy laws. Most regimes do not. There are many accusations of this type. A partial list would include insulting Islam, hurting Muslims' feelings, insulting a heavenly religion, creating confusion amongst Muslims, imitating Christians, sorcery, harboring destructive thoughts, friendship with the enemies of God, fighting against God, dissension from religious dogma, and propagation of spiritual liberalism. That list could be hundreds of items long. Often the charge is not in statute or even in the Constitution, but is culled from a version of Sharia or another authority. In the case of Pastor Yusuf Nadakhani, currently sentenced to death in Iran for converting to Christianity, in arriving at the sentence, the court simply referred to the late Ayatollah Khomeini's Tahrir al-Wasilah, Section 8, which says you should kill apostates. And they said, so we're going to execute you. I will use the terms blasphemy or insulting Islam as general terms covering the whole. For people accused of one of these types of offenses, much of the repression is, of course, carried out by states, such as Saudi Arabia or the Maldives, Algeria, Egypt, and dozens of others. In other cases, probably more cases, accusations, sometimes stoked by governments, lead to attacks by mobs, vigilantes, and terrorists. Many more people are killed and injured by social violence than by direct state action. But a pervasive pattern is governments often refuse to stop mob or terrorist action. There's one example in 2009, after an allegation, a false allegation that a Quran had been torn, a 1,000-strong mob, believed to be connected to the Taliban, rampaged through Christian neighborhoods in Punjab in Pakistan, killing 7 people, most by burning alive. The Pakistani police stood by and did not intervene. So you have state repression, private repression, but often a symbiosis between them. The victims can be quite varied. One group of victims, numbering in the millions, is what I'll refer to as post-Islamic religions. That is particularly Baha'is and Ahmadis. Both these groups are illegal in many countries, are condemned en masse as de facto heretics, as insulters of Islam, and are subject to discriminatory and brutal laws, as well as pervasive state extra-legal violence and then attacks by mobs, even in comparatively moderate places such as Indonesia. The Baha'i leadership in Iran is currently in prison. And Iran, and also in Iran, there is no penalty for killing a Baha'i, since they have no legal status. I could say, again, many more things about Ahmadis, but Amjad, one of our distinguished panelists later on, will say more about that. The many people who leave Islam for another religion, or leave for no religion, face similar persecution as apostates. One example in Somalia, Al-Shabaab is systematically killing every Christian in the country on the grounds that if they are Somali Christians, they must be ex-Muslims and therefore apostates. A third group that suffers persecution is Muslims of the wrong type or in the wrong place. For example, Egypt has imprisoned people for being, and I quote, under the influence of Shia ideas. Saudi Arabia also represses Shiites, especially Ismailis. Iran represses Sunnis and Sufis. In many parts of the Muslim world, differing from the official version of Islam propagated by government religious authorities is dangerous. Another major category, to whom I will devote most attention, is religious and political reformers and dissidents. Amongst those who are silenced are authors, journalists, democracy activists, including Nobel Prize winners. Muslims who question repressive interpretations of Islam can be jailed for insulting Islam, or killed by vigilantes simply for advocating an Islam of freedom. Since Islam is a complex belief system shaping 1.6 billion followers in culture, in politics, economics, science, education, and personal matters, it obviously has a lot of effect on political discourse. But as our survey of Muslim countries in the book Silenced demonstrates, under blasphemy restrictions, a large body of ideas about society in general is no longer open for debate and inquiry. The result is, as the late President Wahid of Indonesia, who wrote the foreword to this book, said, coercively applied blasphemy laws narrow the bounds of acceptable discourse, not only about religion, but about vast spheres of life, literature, science, and culture in general. Because of these political overtones, many governments deliberately manipulate outrage over perceived insult and criticism. It must be emphasized that the anger felt by ordinary Muslims at insults is very real, and let us be clear that we deplore such insults. But the charges, such as we have described, are often, indeed usually, politically channeled by authoritarian rulers to maintain their position. In one striking instance, the government of Sudan had the entire population of the Nuba Mountains, Muslim and Christian, declared apostate as a prelude to a campaign to destroy them. But for other reformers, I'll just give one or two instances in each case, but there are, of course, many thousands. Amongst feminists, Taslima Nasreen had to flee Bangladesh for her life because her writings, principally novels, were accused of being against Islam. In Malaysia, books by the feminist Muslim organization Sisters in Islam are banned. Amongst novelists, the Egyptian Nobel Prize winner in literature, the only Arab-speaking Nobel Prize winner in literature, Naguib Mahfouz, had many of his novels banned in his native Egypt. And he lived under constant protection after being stabbed by a young Islamist, which left him partly paralyzed. Amongst journalists, Afghan Shia scholar Ali Mohakek Nasab, editor of the magazine, whose translated title is Women's Rights, was imprisoned by the Karzai government for publishing un-Islamic articles that criticized the idea of stoning as a punishment for adultery. Amongst theologians, and here I mean Muslim theologians and clerics, Iranian cleric Mohsen Kadivar was imprisoned in Iran for publishing untruths and disturbing public minds. How had he done this? Well, he wrote a very dense three-volume work, The Theories of the State in Shiite Jurisprudence. This work argued that the late Ayatollah Khomeini's teaching about the guardianship of the jurists, that in fact clerics should rule, Kadivar argued that this had no foundation in Shiite jurisprudence. Here we have a theological, political argument about the nature of authority in the Iranian state, and it's treated as a category of blasphemy and insulting Islam. Amongst political reformers, Bangladeshi Salahuddin Chowdhury was imprisoned for hurting religious feelings because he advocated peaceful relations between Bangladesh and Israel. Saudi democracy activists have been imprisoned for using what was called un-Islamic terminology, such as democracy and human rights, when they called for a written constitution. This year, Salman Taseer, the governor of Pakistan's Punjab province, was murdered by one of his guards who deemed him a blasphemer because he opposed blasphemy laws. As Taseer's daughter wrote after this, "This is a warning to every liberal in Pakistan. Shut up or be shot." And there are, of course, numerous other examples. One result is that, as United Nations Arab Human Development reports have commented, in Arab countries where the political exploitation of religion has intensified, there is tough punishment for original thinking, and this intimidates and crushes scholars. When politics and religion are intertwined, as they necessarily are in debates about blasphemy and insulting Islam, then without religious debate and criticism, there can be no political debate and criticism. As Hafez Abu Zayt, driven out of Egypt by Islamists, and we include an essay by him in this book, as he has written, Charges of apostasy and blasphemy are key weapons in the fundamentalist arsenal, strategically employed to prevent reform of Muslim societies, and instead to confine the world's Muslim population to a bleak, colorless prison of socio-cultural and political conformity. My colleague Nina Shea will now recount attempts to push us too into a bleak, colorless prison of conformity. Thank you very much.
I'd like to start by thanking also the Federalist Society for supporting our work and for this conference today. It's a real privilege to be associated with such a great organization. And I particularly want to thank Gene Meyer and Leonard Leo and all the Federalist Society folks who are here, Jim Kelly, David Ray, Thomas Kramer, and then Jonathan, of course. The demand that the West abide by Muslim blasphemy laws came at a precise moment in history. On February 14, 1989, Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran called for all zealous Muslims to quickly execute wherever they find them the British novelist Salman Rushdie and his collaborators on the book Satanic Verses. Khomeini wanted to ensure that, quote, no one will dare to insult Islamic sanctity ever again. The Supreme Leader also needed to shore up his political legitimacy following a devastating and inconclusive war with Iraq. Little did we realize at the time, Khomeini was spearheading a religious trend with political undertones, propelled in the West with a zeal not seen for several centuries. This came just at a time when blasphemy laws to protect Christianity were virtually obsolete. This global push, soon taken up by Sunni powers, largely acting within the Organization of Islamic Conference. The OIC charter commits it to combat defamation of Islam, and its plan of action calls for deterrent punishments by all states to counter Islamophobia. The Saudi-based OIC and its 56 member states gave the anti-blasphemy movement in the West weight and traction and ensured it would not be marginalized. Within the UN for 13 years, the OIC successfully pushed resolutions for a new human right of protecting religion, that is Islam, from defamation. The Universal Declaration for Human Rights defines religious freedom as the right of individuals to choose and practice their faith or no faith at all. But the OIC reinterprets this as respect for religion, particular religion itself. As Paul described, the definition of Muslim blasphemy is amorphous. So are the terms Islamophobia, religious insult, and negative stereotyping of Islam. So what is now being demanded of the West is poorly understood here. This movement would compel Westerners to refrain from burning the Quran, but it would also mean banning and punishing all critical analysis and debate about and within Islam. The OIC expects the secular West to regulate speech on behalf of Islam in a way it no longer does for Christianity or any other body of ideas, in a way, in fact, that is analogous to practices in the OIC states themselves. It is important to note that this campaign has been decades long in the making. It is a multi-party campaign, and it combines international lobbying with other tactics. From the outset, it has been accompanied by violence and intimidation. Rushdie and his partners have been stalked by assassins in at least 7 countries, resulting in the murder or maiming of at least of 5 of them and 41 innocent bystanders. Worldwide riots in 2006 after the Danish cartoons and the Pope's Regensburg speech and drove home this point. A big part of this push is to delegitimize and silence moderate Muslims, those seeking to reconcile Islam with modernity and pluralism, the very ones needed to defeat Muslim ideological extremism. In the West, too, Muslim reformers have been threatened with death, requiring some to go into hiding, others to seek 24-hour protections, and silencing others. Many for defending women's rights, others for supporting individual freedoms. This includes a Danish member of parliament, in fact, our keynote speaker today, a Somalian Dutch member of parliament, a Moroccan Belgian senator, who was threatened with ritual slaughter for criticizing radical influences in Belgian mosques. A Congolese Swedish cabinet minister, a Turkish-German Green Party member of parliament, a Moroccan Italian member of parliament, a Wall Street Journal female journalist from West Virginia who received death threats after calling for the end of gender segregation in American mosques, Khalid Duran, who received death fatwa right up the road in Bethesda, Maryland, for writing a book explaining Islam for the American Jewish Committee. The list goes on. Many Western leaders now are working to accommodate Muslim blasphemy demands through a patchwork of laws, particularly religious and racial hate speech laws, which are turning out to serve as perfect proxies for Muslim blasphemy laws. To be sure, the West still subscribes to the fundamental importance of freedom of expression. Yet entities such as the Council of Europe has issued vague and subjective standards for hate speech, which state that with respect to religion, there is simply no right to offend, that gratuitously offensive speech is not protected, and that within religious freedom, there is a new right of citizens not to be insulted in their religious feelings. Virtually all 47 member states of the Council of Europe now have such hate speech laws. The last two decades have seen growing numbers of Western prosecutions for negative commentary on Islam. Prosecutors in Finland, the Netherlands, and Canada have trawled the websites of anti-immigration advocates looking for evidence that Islam's prophet may have been mocked. The Dutch government has taken the added precaution of creating a standing interdepartmental committee for cartoons to monitor irreverent treatment of Islam. In France, Canada, Norway, and Italy, publishers, editors, and authors have been tried for inciting religious hostility and insulting religious sensibilities with their critiques of Islam and Muslim immigration. In Austria, Elizabeth Sabadish-Wolf, who had lived in Iran and Libya, was recently convicted and may soon face prison time for her briefing to an anti-immigration political party, which, as the verdict put it, quote, depicted Islam in an extremely negative light. In Germany, a man was convicted for the sacrilegious treatment of the word Quran, not the Islamic sacred text itself. Despite France's laïcité system of strict separation of religion and politics, Brigitte Bardot, in her animal rights advocacy, has been convicted and fined five times for denouncing Islamic slaughter practices. A Helsinki court convicted a city councilman after ruling that an argument made by the defense in a Muslim blasphemy case was inadmissible because, quote, logic and so-called arguments of reason have no true significance in debating religious questions. Although so far such convictions are the exception, they nevertheless, the laws themselves chill speech and diminish the value the society places on freedom and fairness. Why is the West going down this path? In large part, it's because of fear. It hopes to buy social peace. This sentiment is captured in a Time magazine article this week on the firebombing of a French satirical magazine, which poked fun of Sharia law being introduced into Tunisia. Time wrote of the French magazine, quote, not only are such Islamophobic antics futile and childish, but they also openly beg for the very violent response from extremists their authors claim to proudly defy in the name of common good. What common good is served by creating more division and anger and by tempting belligerent reactions? In fact, these hate speech prosecutions and laws foster social disharmony and tensions. They do so by creating a rush to litigation by various religious groups within the society. They also empower radicals by giving them a platform. The U.S. has not followed the rest of the West down this slippery slope. The First Amendment here has given us strong protections, and we are one of the only Western nations that now do not have either blasphemy or hate speech laws. There are, however, two worrisome trends. First is self-censorship of negative commentary about Islam in our major, in some of our major institutions. Some examples have been provided by the Yale University Press, Comedy Central, Random House, and a large part of our print media. The government also self-censors. In 2008, Homeland Security and the State Department instructed their employees to avoid the words Salafi, Wahhabi, Caliphate, and Jihadists as offensive to Muslims when used by non-Muslims. On the advice of unidentified Muslim consultants, the word liberty was also dropped in favor of progress. In 2009, Homeland Security Secretary dropped Islamic terrorism in favor of man-made disasters. In 2010, the U.S. National Security Strategy document dropped the term Islamic radicalism. The year before, they had identified Islamic radicalism as, quote, the great ideological conflict of our time. The second worrisome development is the decision by the Obama administration to partner with the OIC to implement strategies on stopping the negative stereotyping of Islam, which, of course, was the president's pledge in his Cairo speech in 2009. The U.S. has jointly sponsored UN resolutions with the OIC on this topic. And next month, it will co-host with the OIC in Washington a summit on this subject of limit the negative stereotyping of Islam here among Americans. We should not partner on the issue of limiting speech with a group committed to undermining our individual freedoms. Among other things, it betrays victims of blasphemy codes abroad. Paul and I hope this conference will give the larger context. It will reframe the debate from regulating insult to what this push is really about, the enforcement of Islamic blasphemy regime here in the West. We hope it will connect the dots between what is happening in the West and what happens in the OIC countries. We hope that Western leaders will begin to launch a robust defense of individual freedoms. Thank you very much.